Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome back to New Books in History, a channel on the New Books Network. I'm your host, Zach McCulley, and today I'm joined by Dr. Richie Robertson. Richie is the professor of the German language and literature at the University of Oxford, and he's a fellow of the British Academy, and he also holds his DPhil from Oxford as well. And he's had a marvelous and impressive academic writing career, and just recently in 2021, he's published a new book with HarperCollins called The Enlightenment, The Pursuit of Happiness, 1680 to 1790. And that is what he is here to discuss with us today. Richie, it's a privilege to meet you, and thank you for joining me on the show today.
Well, thank you very much for inviting me. Let me say a bit about myself and about the book,
sure,
what I hoped to achieve in it. As you said, I'm a professor of German literature, and there's a slightly unusual place for which to start writing about the Enlightenment. I have, though, written a lot about comparative literature, especially in the past 10-plus years, mainly French and English literature in relation to German. And if you profess German literature, you necessarily have to do a great deal of work in the history of philosophy. Besides that, I also want to see literature in a wider historical context and, wherever possible, a European context. The book was commissioned. I had published something which attracted some attention on conspiracy theories in the 18th century. Some conspiracy theories involving Jesuits, some involving Freemasons. Anyway, as a result, the director of Penguin Books in the UK asked me to write a general book on the Enlightenment. I'd never have thought of doing so by myself. However, I produced, on request, a synopsis of the book in 10 chapters. Afterwards, more came into being. That passed muster. Now, what was I trying to do in the book? Well, one of the things I wanted to do, this is fairly obvious, was to oppose the cliché that still exists, though not among scholars, of the Enlightenment as the age of reason. I wanted to make clear that it was at least as much the age of emotion, sympathy, feeling, sensibility, all words much used at the time. Reason was not the same as rationalism. That belongs to the 17th century, the age of Descartes and Spinoza. Think of the Enlightenment professed rather rationality, good sense. And good sense not worked out by a solitary person in his study, but sharpened in conversation. The Enlightenment was above all an age of sociability, an age of clubs and societies. And as I say, that wasn't a very innovative thing to do, but I also wanted to represent the Enlightenment not as even a conversation among dead white male philosophers, but as something that fed into the experience of ordinary people. And so The book begins with happiness, what happiness might consist in, what the obstacles were to achieving happiness, and how happiness was understood. I drew as much as I could on life writings, autobiographies, letters, and so forth. And that, I think, gives the book, I hope, a wider sense of what it was like to live in the Enlightenment. I also wanted to defend the Enlightenment against its enemies and detractors, for it's very widely held that the Enlightenment was an age in which rationalism and organization and bureaucracy regimented people and took away their freedom. The most famous text putting this case is the book Dialectic of Enlightenment, written by the philosophers Horkheimer and Adorno in their American exile. More recently, the Enlightenment is pilloried not only because of the dead white males, but as being racist, Eurocentric, misogynist, and what have you. Now, these charges can be entirely denied, and I haven't tried to whitewash the Enlightenment, but I have maintained that with Hume and Kant, both of whom wrote things which they shouldn't have about other races, that these are small blots on the reputation, but don't disqualify them as great philosophers, and in Hume's case also as a historian, whom we should still read and read attentively. I found, however, that I also had to defend the Enlightenment against its friends. That is, against people with a simplified view of history who want to see the Enlightenment as a direct ancestor of modern liberal politics. It was born in upon me as I read my way through the primary texts, but that just won't do. Democracy, as we understand it today, that is, the entitlement of all adults to vote, was just unthinkable in the 18th century. Even in the American Revolution, not only were women and, of course, slaves excluded from participation, but the voting qualification was restricted. And in order to control the popular vote, the founding fathers invented, as we all know, the Electoral College, so that in the extreme case of the popular vote produced a maverick, the Electoral College could declare that election null and void. But I realize the Electoral College has been a matter of debate recently, and it may long since have served its purpose. But to see the Enlightenment as the ancestor of modern liberal democracy just will not do. Democracy to the Enlighteners meant the popular democracy of ancient Athens, and they saw that such democracy regularly ended in demagogy, and the power of demagogues tended to lead to anarchy, and that in turn to the rule of a single strong man. So I set my face as much as I could against what historians call presentism, that is, judging the past by the values of the present. Now, of course, I live in the present, I live in the 21st century, and I can't avoid being a person of the present. But it's important to me not to allow the prejudices, which I inevitably have, to blind me to what was really going on in the 18th century, so far as I could reconstruct it. So, for example, it was apparent to me in 18th century politics that monarchy was the norm, republics were very rare, and on the whole, enlightened thinkers thought that political reforms would be handed down from above by enlightened monarchs. For that reason, Voltaire was very friendly with Frederick the Great of Prussia, although that relationship ended in tears, and Diderot traveled all the way to St. Petersburg at the invitation of Catherine the Great, who was in fact very good to him, But whether she took his advice on anything is not so clear. So for the Enlightenment, we have to revise our views, and there are one other respect in which we have to do so. It's very commonly held that Enlightened thinkers were simply anti-religious. In fact, the truth is more complicated. Very few were atheists. Those who were found it best to keep their atheism quiet. And it was much more common to be a deist, that is, to believe that God exists and is good, but having created the world, doesn't interfere in it anymore. Now, that is in itself a very radical belief. If you think about it, it does away with the central claim of Christianity, the divinity of Christ, and it arouses a great deal of opposition. But it's still part of the Enlightenment tendency, not to throw Christianity overboard, but to displace the emphasis from theology to morality. This happened not only in Protestant countries, but to some extent also in Catholic countries. The Catholic Enlightenment is a phenomenon that's only come into focus in the last few years, but it was very important. And Catholic Enlighteners, of whom was influential was the Italian cleric and historian Muratori, wanted to reduce the number of feast days, pilgrimages, ritual events, and so forth, and instead encourage people to practice private morality and private devotion. Now, these understandings of the Enlightenment are gathering among scholars, but I wanted to disseminate them more widely and back them up, as I think I have done, by extensive reference to primary sources. So I hope that gives you an idea of what I was trying to do in the book.
Yeah, definitely. That's really helpful. And I'm glad you spent the time to give that summary and explanation of your approach the way you did. You know, I think readers will notice and appreciate as they read how you showed the Enlightenment as diverse, showing it wasn't simply an age of reason, as you say, but an age of emotion, and it wasn't homogenous by any means. I think you demonstrate this in part really well by paying close attention to specific texts.
Yeah.
And so in writing the book, for a general audience, can you tell us how you went about your research and how you determined what texts to be included and what maybe needed to be cropped out?
I shall. I just wanted to mention one other purpose I had in mind, and this is more personal. I wanted to write for a general audience without talking down to people, but also without indulging in academic jargon. I hate academic jargon, and I'm afraid reading books in German about German matters, I come across a good deal of it. It's clear to me that whatever purpose people think they have in using an academic technical language, one purpose is to shut some readers out. I didn't want to do that, but to invite people in. And it was also, so it was important to me to write the book in a tone of voice that I could identify with. Now, how did I go about my business? Well, I'd already read quite a lot of the Enlightenment classics, but I did a lot of rereading. I read Gibbon's Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire right through for the third time in my life. And that was a very rewarding experience. There's a lot that I hadn't read. And when I embark on a project, I always begin with what's most difficult. So I don't understand economics, but I had to make some effort. So I sat down with The Wealth of Nations. And for a time, I felt that I understood political economy, as the 18th century called it, well enough to write at least a basic exposition of it. But don't ask me now. Anyway, Smith is a very rewarding writer, and there are many things in The Wealth of Nations which his ideological admirers don't seem to be aware of. In my discussions with my editor, the idea was that I should provide thumbnail sketches of a number of Enlightenment classics: The Wealth of Nations, The Decline and Fall, Hume's Treatise of Human Nature, the Encyclopédie, and a number of others. When I began planning the book, I had a very careful word count, and I allowed myself 3,000 words for each of these expositions. Of course, like many ambitious plans, I didn't stick to it, and the book became longer than I had originally intended, especially as the original 10 chapters expanded to 14. Originally, for example, I had a single chapter on religion, but the subject is so important that I had to divide it into two. The book is quite largely a critical exposition of texts. I don't just report what people wrote, but I argue with them. And one thing that I do is assign a lot of importance to literature and the reception of literature. If you want to understand what people felt in the past, fiction and drama and poetry are a great resource. So, as some people have pointed out, the real center of the book is an account of the three great emotional bestsellers of the mid-18th century. Richardson's Clarissa, a wonderful novel. People shouldn't be put off by its length. I found it a real page-turner. Rousseau's Le Nouvel Héloïse and Goethe's Sorrows of Werther. All these were massively popular. We have a lot of commentary on them. We have fan letters to the authors. We even have fan fiction, all extremely revealing. And all this documents the Enlightenment as, in large part, an age of sympathy and sensibility. The ability to enter sympathetically into other people's states of mind, other people's feelings, was something cultivated during the Enlightenment and trained by the habit of novel reading. The historian Lynn Hunt has argued this case, and I'm very much indebted to her. It was also important just to read a very great deal. Unfortunately, I was able to spend a year in Germany as a senior research fellow at a research institute, the Lichtenberg Kolleg, in Göttingen. I owe the director a great debt of gratitude. Göttingen has a library, which is the best place in Germany to read about the 18th century. There's a massive amount of material in every European language, and I made good use of it. And as every academic finds, getting away from home and from the obligations that inevitably press on one is the only way to make progress on a major project. So that is basically how I went about it. And I had a plan worked out before I began, and the plan developed, I hope organically, as plans do and should.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Well, I think you included a really good selection of primary source material here. And in fact, the book itself, it has a lot of material itself. It's nearly 800 pages, another few hundred of references. It's really well researched and it covers a range of topics. One of the topics that I noticed here, at least in my own reading, was one that seems to get overlooked a bit in Enlightenment literature, and that's the topic of aesthetics. Richie, can you talk to us some about this chapter, why you've included this chapter on aesthetics, and maybe why it may get left off sometimes?
Yes, I can. I thought about that a bit. The only general study I know that gives a lot of attention to aesthetics is a German one, the book The Philosophy of the Enlightenment by Ernst Cassirer, written in Germany just before he was obliged to flee abroad because of Hitler. Cassirer was a philosopher, a very wide-ranging one. Writers on the Enlightenment have most often been historians. Peter Gay, Robert Darnton, Jonathan Israel, Anthony Pagden in recent years. And they've had a very Anglo-Saxon notion of philosophy. In the German tradition, however, most of the major philosophers have included aesthetics as an important department of philosophy. Kant's Third Critique is about aesthetics. Hegel's Lectures on Aesthetics make an enormous book, much bigger than mine. And Adorno wrote several fat volumes on aesthetic theory. There isn't, in other words, a great tradition of aesthetic writing in which you mustn't forget Schopenhauer and Nietzsche. So the absence of aesthetics from many accounts of the Enlightenment is a bias by historians and a bias in the Anglo-Saxon world. I wanted to make this good, and it's a topic I was fairly at home with. I've lectured on aesthetic theory to graduates for many years, so I had quite a lot of raw material. And it also enabled me to address one of the complaints often brought against the Enlightenment, namely that the Enlightenment was incapable of tragedy, with Enlightenment thinkers were too much given to shallow optimism. Well, that charge can't entirely be rebutted. And I do quote some examples from well-known and obscure thinkers of optimism that now looks rather laughable. But most of the Enlightenment thinkers had a much more realistic outlook on life and didn't think that progress was inevitable or easy. On the question of tragedy, it is, in short, that the Enlightenment didn't produce any tragic drama except in Germany. In Germany, from the mid-18th century onwards, you do have a tradition of tragic theatre, including the masterpieces of Goethe and Schiller. Now, why that is so is a big question that I didn't try to address. But my argument finally was that the Enlightenment was capable of tragedy and produced some, but you have to look for it elsewhere. My candidate for great tragic work is a novel I've already mentioned, Richardson's Clarissa. When you finish that novel, you feel you've plumbed the heights of good and, above all, the depths of evil. The effect is quite shattering. And its popularity in the mid-18th century and among the most astute judges is not at all surprising. So yes, the Enlightenment was capable of tragedy, but people have been looking for tragedy in the wrong place.
Very good. Well, Richie, if we move back again and consider the book again as a whole, and particularly the subtitle, The Pursuit of Happiness. Now, you've argued that The Pursuit of Happiness, it actually gave the Enlightenment its intellectual coherence. And I'm wondering if you can walk us through what exactly this meant in terms of the personal experience during these years. What were the preconditions for personal happiness?
Okay. Well, I didn't explain to Americans where the phrase "the pursuit of happiness" comes from, but in the Enlightenment text, you find the word happiness, and it's French, German, and Italian, synonyms all over the place. But it's very important to distinguish between private and public happiness. Whether you or I can be happy in our lives depends on a lot of things. It depends on luck. It depends on our temperaments. It depends, I suppose, on our genetic inheritance. It depends on whether we're lucky enough to enjoy good health. It depends on our relationships. And obviously, nobody's individual life can be free from unhappiness. That was perfectly clear to the Enlighteners. The Enlighteners tended, when it came to private happiness, to fall back on classical philosophers. Some referred back to Epicurus, who told his fellow Greeks that they shouldn't worry about the gods. The gods either didn't exist or didn't care about humanity and should instead strive for happiness. And the best way to do that was through moderation and temperance in enjoyment. Others were attached to Stoicism. The Stoics taught that the wise man should make himself insensible, unfeeling, and feel as little as possible. That didn't mean being selfish and unconcerned about others, but it did mean cultivating a kind of armor. In the 18th century, although Stoicism lingered on in some writers such as Adam Smith, it was generally disparaged because people pointed out that human nature just isn't like that. You can't make yourself insensible. My favorite example is a place in Fielding's Tom Jones, where a character is introduced who's a Stoic philosopher, as always spouting Stoicism. As he was told, while speaking, he happened, unfortunately, to bite his tongue and made faces in agony for some time. So private happiness, then, is difficult, and you're lucky if you have much of it. But public happiness is another matter. As I mentioned, good health. Well, whether we can enjoy good health depends a lot on the medical services available to us. I'm afraid, by the way, that medical research, as opposed to medical theory, didn't make much progress in the Enlightenment. And I have a couple of dreadful examples of people who recorded their sufferings in being operated on without anesthetic. But public happiness means providing a framework which people can lead their lives and pursue happiness with at least as few as possible of the avoidable obstacles. Increasingly in the 18th century, enlightened monarchs, what were called at the time enlightened despots, the now historians prefer to talk about enlightened absolutism, thought of their duty to work on behalf of the well-being of their subjects. They ceased to regard the subject simply as an exploitable resource and to find themselves, in the words that Voltaire put in the mouth of Frederick the Great, as the first servants of the people. Frederick, Catherine the Great of Russia, and Joseph II of Austria, and a number of smaller rulers and ministers of the 18th century were consciously devoted to the public good or to their conception of it. Now, that meant taking charge of what at the time was called police. Police in French and in English, Polizei in German. That means public order, public infrastructure, roads, bridges, and canals, as well as the prevention of crime. The German state especially, and don't forget that until the end of the 18th century, there were about 300 German principalities, large, small, and very small, each had a staff of civil servants who were increasingly often trained at university, and in many cases, devoted to the conception of the public good. Not in all. You find some who embezzled money or who behaved with great incompetence, but on the whole, they did their best. Similarly in France, although very much less power, the provincial administrators like Turgot struggled to improve the public good with the limited resources at their available at their disposal. Now, again, modern critics of the Enlightenment have often focused on these administrators and called them tyrannical busybodies. That's what Michel Foucault's case against the Enlightenment comes down to. And certainly, the many proclamations that these administrators issued suggest by the very number and the number of times that they were repeated, they were often not very effectual. What Foucault calls, with some exaggeration, the Great Confinement was an attempt to deal with beggars and with the destitute, by putting them into, and with the mad, by putting them into institutions. And it must be said that in all Western countries, administrators wrestled with the problem of what to do with this straitened society with very little success. Institutions in Britain and America, workhouses, prisons, were very inadequate answers. One very radical example was the Philadelphia Penitentiary, pioneered by the Dr. Benjamin Rush, in which people were supposed to be cured of their vices by being subjected to solitary confinement. Dickens visited the Philadelphia Penitentiary on his tour of America in 1840 and was horrified to see people condemned to a living death. So these administrators didn't get everything right, and some things they definitely got wrong, but the motive behind their work was an attempt to create public happiness. And if beggars are cleared off the streets, then the rest of the population are happier for it. There may be hard luck for the beggars.
Very good. Well, I appreciate that really thorough answer, especially how private happiness is relating to public. Richie, suppose there are some readers who are interested in this book, who want to explore more secondary literature on the Enlightenment. Where would you direct them? What are some good introductory readings on the Enlightenment?
There is one I can certainly recommend. The author is also called Robertson, John Robertson, no relation of mine, though we have already sometimes been confused. He brought out in 2015 a little book on the Enlightenment in the series Very Short Introductions, published by Oxford University Press. You can read it in an afternoon, or perhaps two afternoons, and I know enough about the material to see that John has done a really expert job in bringing in practically every aspect of the Enlightenment. And he wears his knowledge very lightly. His approach differs from mine in that he begins with a chapter on philosophy, which, with the best will in the world, is somewhat heavy going. There's not much to be done about that. Whereas I introduce the reader to the Enlightenment in a different, more gradual way, by writing about everyday life and the preconditions and difficulties of happiness. But John's book contains everything concisely and lightly. And as I say, a first reading will only take you at most two afternoons. I'm a little hesitant to recommend other secondary books because recent books have very strong bias towards the history of political thought. That's the case with, for example, the massive encyclopedic volumes by Jonathan Israel. You may think there's a lot of material in my book. It is absolutely dwarfed by Israel's gigantic tomes. One can learn a huge amount from them, but he does have a particular bias, and he makes great claims for the radical wing of the Enlightenment, which I don't think myself could be sustained. Lighter and an easier read is Anthony Pagden's book of 2013, The Enlightenment and Why It Matters. Pagden is a historian, and a historian particularly of political thought. He has a great range of languages, but he's most at home in the history of Spain, which did have an Enlightenment, but is inevitably rather marginal in any account of the Enlightenment. So I do recommend Paddington with these reservations. Or more recently, the Italian scholar Vincenzo Ferroni has brought out several books on the Enlightenment, the most recent being History of Human Rights, which is now available in English. But I do think Israel, Paddington, and Ferroni do fall into the trap of presentism, which I've tried to avoid. And I would recommend people, after a certain time, to stop reading about the Enlightenment and read the Enlightenment texts, which are available in English, in handy editions. Read Voltaire's short fiction. Read his philosophical dictionary, which is a very witty book. Read Hume's essays, very short and pithy. Read some of Kant's short essays. Read Gibbon's autobiography. And if you like that, go on and tackle the decline and fall. So don't read about the Enlightenment beyond a certain point. Read the Enlightenment.
It sounds like a fine recommendation. Well, Richie, it's been a real pleasure to discuss your book, and you've been really gracious with your time now. But before we go, can you share with our listeners what writing projects you plan to work on next?
Okay. I'm putting the finishing touches to a book on Nietzsche. Hmm. The lockdown forced on us by the pandemic had its advantages for me, in that I had piece to write this book. And my take on Nietzsche is that Nietzsche in the middle period, roughly 1878 to 1882, presents himself as an heir and continuator of the Enlightenment. I think the middle period is underestimated, and the later works, which are more dramatic and in many respects more shocking, indeed one should be shocked by many things in them, have been a bit overrated. In the further future, I have a book on the stocks, which is about German political drama from the 17th century, probably down to the 1960s, in relation to, at various periods, Machiavellianism, reason of state, and Realpolitik. So it will be about political drama intertwined with the history of political thought and the history of government. Some parts of that already exist as published articles, much more in a very unpresentable rough draft, and that will be a project for my imminent retirement. Thank you for asking.
Very good. Wonderful. Well, for now, thank you, Dr. Richie Robertson, for writing this new book, The Enlightenment, The Pursuit of Happiness, 1680 to 1790. It's published in 2021 with Harper, an imprint of HarperCollins. And Richie, thank you so much for joining me today.
You're very welcome. Thank you for asking me.
And thank you all for listening. I'll see you next time on New Books in History, a channel on the New Books Network.